actually one of the first space level confrontations happened not between China and the US, but between the Houthis and Israel.
Hamas have clearly maintained some sort of form and ability. They just killed Israel's chief local militant. How?
So Hamas was, to be very clear, outnumbered, outgunned, outclassed, besieged.
How would Syria be able to rebuild its capability, given that they have to kind of do this dance, this political dance?
The RSF is a force that was patrolling and at some points even fighting on the horses of camels, on horses and camels. And now it can field long-range 1,200 kilometers strikes, precision strikes, that lands in Port Sudan.
Do you trust Ahmad al-Sharaa?
That's a very, very difficult question.
Stand by.
Right. I'm waiting for that guy to count me down in my ear.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, sure. Okay, no, I realized I didn't have it yet.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Hi, good day and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. This time I'm coming with to you from the Doha Forum, and I'm pleased to have with me today Omar Ashour. Omar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Omar Ashour is someone who I think will be perfect to have this discussion today that we're going to have. He's an expert in the Middle East, specifically when it comes to thinking about and writing about Islamist movements, military aspects that's been going on in the region. He's a thinker and an author, and so I'm very pleased to have him with us. We're going to be speaking about the region and its current state, taking into consideration three things. We've just heard from Ahmad al-Sharaa and Syria, and that's changed a lot in the last year. We'll speak about that. We'll speak about how the region has changed because of Gaza's genocide. And we'll also speak about how Gulf countries have been flexing, both Qatar here and the UAE, and how that's impacting the region. So just to start off with, we both just heard from Ahmad al-Sharaa, who was being interviewed by Christian Amanpour. Last year, as she said, and we've all been noting, last year he was around this time, heading into Damascus, with some tanks. And Lavrov and Hakan Fidan had to broker some peace to assist that process. Obviously, I'm sure the Americans were involved, the Turks were involved elsewhere, the Israelis were possibly involved as well to ensure all of this occurred. But now he is on stage as a statesman speaking. Syria has obviously been through a lot of changes. You wrote 17 years ago a book literally called, I may get this wrong, so just correct me, the de-radicalization of jihadists.
Absolutely right.
Right? Transforming Islamist movements.
Right.
You were like a prophet. Sorry, go for that.
Transforming armed Islamist movements.
Just to be more precise.
Just to be precise, yeah.
So, I mean, no one could probably imagine 17 years ago when you wrote that book what would occur, but just how do you see this whole situation?
To be very fair, I did not, when I wrote the book, I was meaning more organizations that not as far as Al-Qaeda and as ISIS. It was jihadism, but sometimes I joke jihadism light, but that picture of President al-Sharaa with General Petraeus shaking hands and having a laugh, and I think President al-Sharaa asked him, where are my $10 million, the bounty, because I'm here now. And General Petraeus said, well, I'm retired now, and that moment, I think that I wouldn't have imagined it. But we know that the transformation happens. Organizations, factions within organizations and individuals transform on an ideological level, so they see the worldview different. It's a different worldview. It's a worldview without this incessant legitimization of political violence, as in case of jihadists, on theological interpretations. It's sort of abuse of religion in a way. But also you will see behavioral transformation. So you change the behavior when it comes to political violence, the use of terrorism, and also you are more acceptable for the other, between quotations, so the religious other, the sectarian other, and so on. And also it happens on the organizational level. So you have a complete, in this case, a complete transformation of the organizational structure, command and control, and so on. But what is very interesting in this particular case is that this happened after a victory. Usually, most of the cases, including the cases in the book I was talking about, are cases of organizations that were defeated and they had to transform either in prison or in the mountains and the rugged terrains, their strongholds, or cases of the organizations that reached a sort of what I called in the book firefight fatigue. You know, they were fighting for a long time and they are tired. The state fighting them is also tired. So now we need to have a chat and to legitimize the chat, the negotiations process, you need to transform in that direction. So it's either a defeat or a draw. But the cases of victory, you come from above, you win, you enter the against all the odds and against the advices, shall we call it that, the advices of your own allies. Turkey was not supportive of that advance, you know. Let's be very true about it, you know. With all the due respect of President Trump, you know, that idea that, you know, that somebody in Ankara or Istanbul pressed the button and then there was an advance, that was not true. We know the policy right before Radel Adwan or the operation that led to the fall of Aleppo and then later on Damascus. So in that sense, that's a transformation from above, and that's very rare. It happened very few times, perhaps arguably in Sandinistas in 1994, when they won the fight by an armed revolution in 79, and then handed over after losing the elections in 1994. So that was one of the case transformation from above. Some may say the revolutionary forces in Ethiopia in Addis, you know, and also it was not transformation towards democracy, but it was a coalition of the victorious kind of compromises, but very, very rare cases, and that's one of them when you have a transformation from above. And I think he replied in a very fiery way, as you see from the amount of claps that he got to questions that were significant, including the terrorism question, and he clearly mentioned he's not a scholar, but he actually mentioned the only part of the terrorism definition that almost everybody agrees upon, because he was absolutely right. There is no scholarly or policy definition for terrorism. We don't agree. So now we're 24, 25 years after 9/11, we still don't have a UN unanimous definition of terrorism. We have over 250 definitions. But the only segment of the definition, the common denominator, if you wish, that everybody agrees about is that they're targeting civilians for political effects, usually by an end state force. And he replied, well, there's no definition. And actually, if you're talking about targeting civilians, you need to take a look at Gaza. You need to take a look at what happened in Syria by the regime. And you need to take a look at what happened in Iraq. And of course, he did not mention Ukraine, but you need to take a look at what's happening in Ukraine. And then you can ask who exactly is the bigger terrorist here. Okay.
So, I mean, we're talking about these three things, right? And I'm going to come back to Syria, but I just want to lay out the chessboard, if we can, for the audience. So Gaza, Syria, and obviously both Qatar and other and the UAE in a massive way in Sudan and in Libya for a long period, not just recently. The region is very different to what it was 3 years ago. It's extremely different to what it was in 2010, pre Arab revolutions occurring in various capitals. They are all related, right? If you were trying to explain to someone who's in their first year studying how they're related, what would be your stab at it?
Between Gaza
all of these impacts are sort of interrelated. If it was not for Israel overreaching and significantly hurting Hezbollah, I doubt that this would have occurred, that Sharjah would be able to make his run in Damascus. Secondly, Israel's overreach is it's partly why Sharjah is here talking about the fact that Israel is bombing parts of Syria. And Syria has bombed Doha.
Yeah.
I mean, Israel has bombed Doha, and they've been bombing Lebanon, and they've bombed Tunis.
Yeah.
And the UAE has been quite instrumental in also fomenting a lot of instability in Yemen, in Libya, in Sudan. Through their actions, both in Yemen and Sudan, they're rubbing up against the Saudis. So there's all of these things occurring, and make it make sense to, you know, to like a first year who's just heard, you know, a few of these things.
So, so you're absolutely right. I'll give you a competitive perspective.
Yes.
So the Soviet military thinkers used to think that the area from the Baltics to the Mediterranean, this is one theater with multi-fronts, but it's one theater. And later on, there was an extension all the way to the Red Sea, all the way to actually the Aden Gulf. So all this area is an arc, and it's one theater, and it has multiple fronts. And those fronts, whether we like it or not, either support or undermine each other. And in terms of their strategic thinking, the argument is that these multiple fronts in that one theater should support each other for the benefit of the Soviet Union. And what you're saying basically is that things did not change, you know? So you had a theater that started in Gaza on the 7th of October, which was unprecedented in terms of a non-state force conducting combined arms, multi-domain, meaning air, sea, electronic information warfare, so multi-domain offensive with combined arms, with motorized infantry, with drones, with light infantry, and then it unfolded. What happened for 2 years, and part of that you had for probably an unprecedented synchronization of multiple non-state forces who are supporting Hamas and Gaza, whether from Yemen, in the case of the Houthis, which is a hybrid actor, really. It's not a non-state force. It's actually a government.
Yes.
You know, it's part of a government and part of a coalition wider than the organization itself. And you had the case of Hezbollah, and you had the case of the Iraqi, few Iraqi non-state forces as well, like Hezbollah battalions, Kataib Hezbollah, and others. All of them synchronizing in a way that escalated what I explained in terms of the multi-front and multi-domain, to the extent that one of the first space-level confrontations happened not between China and the U.S., but between the Houthis and Israel, because they fired a ballistic missile that was intercepted exo-atmospherically by an LO3 system, which is an air defense system that intercepted the missile outside of the Earth's atmosphere. So that's a space war, basically.
Yep.
So it escalated to that level. And of course, each of these theaters affected each other. And you're absolutely right. That degradation of of Hezbollah's capabilities. Well, first, Hezbollah had to remove many of its forces from Syria to mobilize on the southern Lebanese borders, because they knew that things are going to escalate there. And then they lost many of these sources, and then lost many of, well, a very large portion, I would argue probably the majority of their munition and weapon assets and warehouses and so on, lost their commanders and so on. So it was a very quick degradation of the forces. Some of the Iraqis as well that were support. So just to explain to the listeners, only in 2017 I wrote a piece on, you know, the military performance of the Syrian revolution was very high, but the political performance was very low. The Syrian revolution in 2017. So we're talking about 8 years before, yes, or 7 years before before the
around Damascus, yeah, the liberation.
Yeah, the liberation of Damascus has killed over 100,000 of the forces of Assad. Okay, and that 100,000 needed to be replaced, and the way they were replaced by mainly militias and non-state forces. Some from Pakistan, some from Afghanistan, like the Fatemiyun, some from Pakistan, like the Zainabiyun, and those were, Fatemiyun became like a division size, so thousands, and Zainabiyun was about a regiment size unit, but also from Iraq, like the Nujaba movement and Kataib Hezbollah and others, and Hezbollah. Hezbollah was the most experienced and most combat effective. But once that gets undermined, and there was no really buildup of Assad's forces, and it was completely degraded. So it was really the attrition, not the maneuver that happened, not only the maneuver that happened in last year led by al-Shara, but it's the entire degradation of that force over a very long period of time And after 7th of October, the degradation of the combat units that were quite effective, including Hezbollah's units. So yeah, it was an easy fight. It was not an easy, is a completely wrong word. It was the less difficult fight because of the long war and because of the attrition and because of what you mentioned, the connectedness of these fronts in a single city.
Okay. So, I mean, I think it's interesting. And right now, I'm just going to throw back to what we just heard Ahmed al-Shara say, and you highlighted a bit of it. But Krishna Mampur was speaking to him, and she was asking about the fact that, you know, I mean, there are incidents right now of vengeance against the Alawites and Druze, people who are supportive of Assad. And you mentioned a lot about this war. Try to tell us more about how this massive 14-year civil war, which was, you know, quiet at times, and at other times, barrel bombs were falling on cities, and thousands of people were killed. 10 million people were made refugees. It was really a really massive war. Give us, you have to some extent already, but try to tell us more exactly just how it's impacted Syrian society, and how that makes Ahmed al-Sharaa's job now to try to create stability in Syria even more difficult.
So there are two major ramifications, and this is I'm taking the 60,000 feet look from above. One of it is, in a way, believe it or not, it makes his job less difficult because of the horrors that happened before. So probably Syrians would understand the horrors of instability, of the ramification of violent sectarianism, violent extremism, terrorism, both state and non-state terrorism, more than most people, I would say, on the planet. They suffered from that. So they don't want to repeat this episode. So this is what gives you hope and what gives you an incentive to make this work and to try to avoid the horrors of the past, of the recent past, because it can be a new generation, so they don't understand the horrors. So we're talking now about the same generation that went through the horrors. So hence, this gives an incentive. But there's a big but. He's starting from, relatively speaking, a legacy that was very cruel, bloody, and with state institutions that were either not functioning or because of the corruption and the repression became so ineffective. So he'll need to deal with all of that. He'll need to build up capacities, expertise, hence education and media, and what the Gulf here and other partners are doing are very important. And he will need a lot of finances because the country is not is in big trouble financially. It has opportunities, and I think he mentioned some of that in his talk. But then it is major challenges. But he has two things. He can rely on the recent past in terms of trying to avoid that, and that collective will to avoid that. And also, they, in a way, relying on the Syrian people. They're very skillful people. They're very skillful and very willing to move forward from the horrors of the past and not to repeat it. So he got that in his corner. And he got some support from, as you saw from the claps today, there was a lot of regional support, at least, and international support with the U.S. and so on. So they hopeful in that sense. But also major challenges we saw, not least of which is the consistent Israeli strikes on Damascus and elsewhere in Syria.
Okay.
So sectarianism that did not go away.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, more specifically on his job. So Israel has been striking, and they've struck more than 1,000 times. There's been more than 400 sort of incursions. They just recently killed 25 Syrians in an operation. They're basically at war. I mean, if they weren't genociding Gaza at the same time, this would be a massive, escalation. And they've also bombed Lebanon more. So Syria is basically a country, not that Gaza is a country, but sort of the place that they've attacked the most. Obviously, they've attacked the West Bank as well in a different way. But if there wasn't, if that wasn't happening, this is massive escalation. But I think it gets lost because, you know, Israel is actually dropping a lot more bombs on Gaza and on Lebanon. And, you know, they got continuing the atrocities in the West Bank. But how does he deal with this? Because I can see that initially, you know, this was almost done as like sort of a white rose. You can take out our military capability. We're not interested in, you know, in continuing offensive sort of stance towards you. Not that Assad was actually, you know, doing something offensive against Israel. It was just rhetorical. But there's that, and there's all the sectarian legacy, right? There were questions today asked, and I think it's not just questions that Christian Amanpour has asked, but all of us are asking, is Shara like really a true Democrat? You know, is he speaking democratically, or will he be able to leave in time? If he leaves, will there be a chance of another vacuum occurring? You know, is democracy actually going to be ripe in 4 years or 6 years, or maybe all of these challenges together? Where do you think it's going? How do you see this playing out?
So the easier question and the saddest probably is about the democracy. I don't know how is this going to develop in terms of the riskiest part is the democratization yes. process in Syria, because that will be the most difficult, I would say. And part of the that's a small story about the other book that I wrote on how ISIS fights. Part of it had to do with I looked at a tactic that was actually employed by his former organization Jabhat al-Nusra. In a takeover of Aleppo's officers' club in the middle of Aleppo. It was a very, very effective tactic. The Free Syrian Army failed to take that position for 3 weeks of conventional attacks with infantry and mortars, and those guys took the position in about 8 minutes with a very, I would say, innovative tactic. And when I saw this on camera, I was thinking, why would these guys democratize? You know, like if you can do something like that very effectively with very cheap means, this is about 6 suicide cards. This is all it took, and a squad of infantry to take a command post that was highly guarded with 3 cement belts around it. So it was a very fortified position. So I was thinking, well, why would they democratize? Okay, you can take over a country with that level, and then after you take over the country, you don't have to democratize. But then things changed, because we see actually movement towards democratization for international legitimacy and so on, and because of the pressure of the partners and so on. So maybe it will work. But the other one is that the other bit, which is security-based, security of Syria, national security of Syria, because it's violated now in many ways, whether by secessionists or whether by Israeli occupation or others. So on that one, there are actually three, shall we say, levels. So we have the level of first, the Israeli side. So the Israeli side, right now, operationally speaking, I'm unsure about strategically, but operationally speaking, they have no counterbalance, meaning that Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza have no air defenses, and they cannot mobilize enough force to stop or repel or rebellate their territories in any way or another. Okay. So they cannot do that because of the capabilities. Strategically speaking, so the IDF in 1982, when they invade Lebanon, they marched all the way to Beirut. On their way, they managed to suppress about 12 Syrian batteries, air defense batteries, drop down over 65 Syrian planes, and remove in a period between June and August, so about 3 months, over 20,000 PLO fighters from Beirut and from the rest of Lebanon. Okay, so that's if you looked at it, that's a major, major operational success. You know, in 3 months, you know, we're talking in Gaza, we were talking about 2 years of fighting, and you know, yes, Hamas is still there. So they did this in 2 months, but then what happened? Hezbollah happened. You know, and it was actually much more effective than the PLO, and it kept on. It had multiple. 2000 was a win. 2006 was at least a draw. So it was a most effective force that really bothered the Israeli forces for a long time.
Okay.
With the Syrians, they need to remember Lebanon, because you can have an operational victory now, but later on, much better strategic threat, much riskier strategic threat on the long run. For the Syrians, I think they will maneuver. They will find, because it's their land in the end, and it's their national security. And the Israelis are attacking. They're not defending. It's not like the Syrians are firing missiles into Israel. But the Syrians are saying, well, we had enough. We want to stop this, and the Israelis are on the offensive. So for the Syrians, they have no choice. You cornered them. So they will maneuver. They will probably try to find partners. They will probably try to, you know, rebuild their defenses in different ways, in different patterns. So they will maneuver in that sense. And then the most important is also the very important is the regional and the international levels. And this is where I think there will be a lot of Gulfian support in one sense, and also as we saw from the Trump administration, possible as well attempting to check their Israeli partners.
Okay. So you mentioned that, you know, that the Syrians in the long run will obviously try to replenish some pool of resistance, you know, as a nation, as a sovereign nation, not necessarily, you know, because of, I mean, in this case, Israel is obviously the threat, but it's just as a sovereign nation, this is what nations do. At the same time, they have to consistently will have to work to ensure that the sanctions stay lifted. And of course, you can't rebuild the country without the sanctions. Obviously, Turkey is a very big ally. Qatar is an ally to an extent. The Saudis are big allies. I mean, almost the entire region has you know, been supportive of the revolution. And it seems like the White House is supportive as well. And you know, and the Israelis, they're just being Israelis in the sense that they're just bombing and bombing and bombing. But at the same time, they're not necessarily hostile as well, like rhetorically, right? So they're bombing, but they kind of like, this is, you know, the axis of Iran has been weakened and this is better for us in a way. And I mean, it's not surprising Israel's behavior, but just how does the Syrians, and in this case, it's Sharaa, but it just forget about him. Like, how would Syria be able to rebuild its capability, given that they have to kind of do this dance, this political dance to keep people happy and to, you know, survive?
This will take time, but they will probably need an entire package of first military reforms and security reforms and a new national security doctrine that more or less identifies, one, the targets, what are we exactly trying to do in terms of, shall we say, building and enhancing our air defenses, employing perhaps drone warfare, entrenching areas, building fortifications and trenches in areas that the Israelis might target next, and so on. But that requires a state. That requires a state and a control over the state, and they're not there yet. So it's still you know, part of Sweden. You know, the Syrian army cannot enter there, and there are other parts of Syria in the east that they cannot they don't exercise control over. And today, I think he mentioned Raqqa and there, and I was thinking, yeah, that's in the future. You say he made a mistake and thought that you know, we entered Aleppo and Daraq, and I was like, yeah, that's in the future, but this is not the present. So there's still city. So it needs to be gradual in a way, but they will need that entire pack once, or actually, it doesn't have to be sequential. It probably needs to be simultaneous. A very large packet of security and military reforms, followed by the trying to exercise control over the entire territory of Syria, and then the last stage would be the liberation of whatever is occupied, whether by negotiations or by force. But that's a long term project. I'm not talking about. We're talking here about years, if not decades.
Okay. I mean, I maybe if we have time, because we have a limited time in this interview, we come back to discuss Sharaa. And just obviously, you've studied, you know, this particular subject. So many people kind of, you know, they project onto Sharaa. What I've realized when I speak to anyone, because you speak to people on the far left, you speak to people who are sympathetic to, you know, Islamism, etc. People seem to always project onto him what they think he is. But I want to ask you more about him later, but let's come back to that. You mentioned that, you know, Israel was able to deplete southern Lebanon in 1982 quite swiftly, and then Hezbollah replaced them. They've been fighting Hamas and the Palestinian people in Gaza, because it doesn't look like, you know, a very by any stretch of description a targeted fight at all. It's been very indiscriminate. Almost the whole of Gaza is now rubble. Hamas just recently killed. I mean, it's most likely Hamas killed Yasser Abu Shabab, who, you know, was someone who was a military actor being financed and supported by Israel to the extent where he was literally often being driven into Israel proper, and, you know, being furnished with money and snacks and that kind of thing. Like, really strange. It's the strangest thing. I think we'll make for a fascinating story one day. So how is it? And partly the answer, I think, is that Israel obviously has, they're not really focusing on Hamas. They're just focusing on ethnically cleansing Palestine or Gaza specifically. But I mean, Hamas have clearly maintained some sort of form and ability. They just killed Israel's chief local militant. How?
So, that's a forthcoming article with the title of How Hamas Fights, actually. Yes. It should be out in this month. And I was trying to understand, I started with this dilemma, really. I started with a historical anecdote, which is the Israeli armed forces in June 1967 defeated a larger Egyptian armed forces in Sinai in about 35 hours and controlled the entire 60,000 square kilometers of Sinai in 72 hours. You see the speed?
Yep.
And that's over air, over on the ground, and in the sea, plus a bit of electronic warfare and intelligence information warfare as well. The cyber was out of the question, AI and this stuff. And again, if this is a one-off, then you say it's a one-off. It did the same thing, as I said, in 82 with a non-state force in urban environment. And then when it came to Hamas in Gaza, it struggled for 2 years. It could not achieve its announced operational and strategic objectives for over at least 14 months. And then, we can argue what happened with the rest of the period, but they could not do this for a very large period compared to 35 hours or 3 months in the case of Lebanon. And part of it is what Hamas had done in terms of the preparations for, one, the subterranean defense in depth, two, the amount of preparation, training in terms of combined arms, in terms of fighting in multi-domain, in terms of that what I call horizontal escalation on multiple fronts with other non-state actors. And the information operations that was going on, information intelligence operations. So it's an entire defensive ecosystem that Hamas has employed in Gaza that imposed a strategic drag on a much superior force. So Hamas was, to be very clear, outnumbered, outgunned, outclassed, besieged. So on all levels, you would imagine that 35 hours that it took them to defeat the Egyptian army would happen to Hamas immediately. But this did not happen. And it dragged for a very long time. And then they escalated the costs and so on. So back to Bushabab. So Israel is you have to hand it to them. They are very skillful in both conventional and unconventional in terms of special operations and so on, warfare, in terms of very fast mobilization. They mobilized very quickly for the invasion of Gaza. So 300,000 reservists in about a week. Took Russia about a year to do so. To get the same number, despite the vast differences in sizes and population, geography, and everything. But they are not very good in what I call militia management and irregular warfare. So compared to the Iranians, for example, the Iranians are like number one in the game, probably. And then the Israelis have first the LNA, not the LNA, that's the Libyan, the Lebanese southern, the Lebanese, Southern Lebanese, SLA, the Southern Lebanese Army, which is Aoun's army. And it was a very ineffective, corrupt force. And in the end, it had to flee into Israel. And it was illegitimate. It was looked at, because of the Israeli connection, as completely illegitimate. Okay. They tried to do a few of these forces back in Sinai in the days, and they failed. And then they did it in Gaza again with Bushabab and a few other militias. So historically, they were not very effective in doing so. And it was with Shabab, I was asked about him a couple of times, because I do a bit of non-state forces, and I looked at it was not a huge militia. It was lightly armed. They didn't trust them with any heavy weapons. So it was more of a light infantry, not even a battalion level. It was like a company level force, motorized. They had some armored vehicles, but not much. In a way, you looked at it, they were not very well trained from the movements, from the tactics. They were not very well trained. They were more like a propaganda one. So looking at this, not very well trained, it's not a Sahwat system, in terms of the Americans in Iraq. It was not 100,000 with at least they had infantry, more artillery with them, very well established in their own areas. They had some tribal legitimacy and so on. So they were much rooted. And it was very difficult. And they're fighting a smaller force, which is, back then it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI. So a much smaller force and so on. So that wasn't that. That was a tiny group without legitimacy, because it's associated with the occupier. More than associated with tribal forces, as in the case of the Sahwat and so on. I was not surprised, by the way, when whatever happened, whether it's an inter-tribal thing or Hamas has assassinated him, it doesn't, I was not surprised either way, because of the historical record.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you mentioned Hamas, have built a subterranean infrastructure, and this is to a large extent how they've maintained this. Often, this is used, in TV debates and in the all Israeli spokesperson as this moral argument that, Hamas used all this billions of money, they just built tunnels, and now we have to go and build hospitals and homes, and they've literally turned Gaza into rubble because of that. What's your response to that? I mean, because of course it's a completely ridiculous argument. You can't smack someone repeatedly and then say, "Oh no, this is because you don't want to be smacking, so I'm smacking you." But just what do you think, given the holistic perspective, not the security perspective, over the last 15 years or however long it's been, 17 years since 18 years now since the first siege of Gaza was actually instituted, not the first, but like the Titan siege, after Hamas came to power. What's your response? Do you think Hamas should have, they have behaved in a way where they did obviously make overtures to Israel, and we've talked about that a lot on the show, did extend, various peace proposals. But do you think this was the best use of the resources they had?
It could have been resolved, of course. So the objectives were, one, degrading the capabilities of Hamas, two, releasing the hostages, and three, that this is undeclared, but from the way that war was conducted in Gaza is make Gaza uninhabitable,
yes,
which will mean more or less a forced deportation, yes, of the entire Palestinian or Gazan population there, which seems to be actually some of the politicians who are not representatives of the government, but Israeli politicians who have declared that implied that in their statement. If we took the first two, first the hostages, okay. The hostages, the largest batch of the hostages that were released in negotiations. Actually, Qatar mediated this with Egypt and the U.S. So that could have been resolved by negotiations. The military degradation, which was very important after 7th of October for Israel, it was done already, probably in the first 2 months. But then, of course, Hamas will be able to reconstitute. I think it was a statement of the former chief of staff that they are able. First, they are able to recruit younger and more brave men in terms of replenishing their units that were degraded and attrited. So it's in terms of imposing a strategic drag. That's a strategic drag. When you know that the force you're fighting is going to reconstitute, and you still kill probably tens of thousands of civilians, knowing that you will not reach the objective. Here's the moral issue and dilemma. And I'm not a lawyer, but the Genocide Association, the Genocide Studies Association of scholars who are experts on the genocidal issue, have declared have said multiple times that that military strategy in Gaza fulfills the definition of genocide. Multiple times. So,
okay. What do you think? I mean, now there's this 21-point plan actually by Trump that was instituted. Obviously, there hasn't really been a ceasefire. I think it's been like 6 weeks now. It could be longer. Israel has continued to kill many Palestinians. daily bombings. You know, Hamas, as a result, I don't think they were really going to do this anyway, but they are not, they cannot disarm because they're fighting, you know, militias that are financed by Israel. They're being bombed. Israel has made Gaza unlivable. They are making it, it's very difficult for aid organizations to still work or act. There's been reports that Israel are now flooding parts of Gaza with narcotics. This is not new. This is something that they've been doing for a while. And, you know, I mean, it's what do you think happens? Will there ever be an international force? How will they operate? Is this just really going to be a slow death for the people of Gaza who's had a horrible 60, 70 years and an extra horrible last 2 years? Where do you see this ending?
That's a very, very difficult question. The problem is, well, when you start a war with that magnitude and that level of loss of life and destruction, and you don't agree on the proposed end games, you don't have an end game, and you don't agree on the proposed end games, it's a recipe for disaster, for continuous, for a sustained disastrous humanitarian situation, which is what we have now in Gaza. What is the solution? There are multiple solutions. They were proposed by some of the Israeli politicians before anybody else, who were not in government, but I don't know when they will be in government at any point. They are Israeli politicians opposing the current government, by the Qataris, by the Egyptians, and by the Americans, most recently, pushing towards there, and nothing has happened. And no movement, almost. That includes what you've mentioned in terms of having an international force, an Arab force, the PA, a combination of Palestinian unity government. So all these were proposed. There is no agreement, primarily by Mr. Netanyahu's government. When you don't have an end game and you're not proposing an acceptable end game or an executable end game, and you don't accept any alternative strategies or plans for an end game, then you're implying that your solution is just killing more people and destroying further and further and delving deeper and deeper in war crimes. And I don't know if this is unstoppable. Then we're in a very, very difficult, probably unprecedented situation, because it didn't happen in Lebanon, didn't happen in Gaza before. So this is all new. We are in uncharted, very, very dangerous territories at the moment.
Yep. I mean, it seems like, and you see, and now I'm just listening to Ahmed al-Sharaa as well, because he has been patient in dealing with Israel. In the sense that, you know, they ignored Israel's strikes on the southern part of Syria, as Israel has been diminishing consistently and degrading their military capability. But he did started to sound quite frustrated, naturally, and I'm sure he is. He was like, basically, we showed our posture to Israel. We showed that we know we're willing to deal with them as a state, to recognize them. They didn't formally recognize them, but he definitely gave that kind of impression. But they're still bombing us, and now this is a problem. He's getting frustrated. I'm sure he's not the only actor in the region that's getting frustrated. I'm sure the Saudis, who were probably on a path to normalize, are now frustrated, not only because they will look embarrassed in terms of their own population's sort of political world that they probably want to see as a Palestinian state, but just from a geopolitical perspective, it's like, how can we deal with this neighbor who just doesn't listen to anyone? So the entire region, I mean, I'm sure even Egypt is probably like, when are these guys going to stop? Like, how can we have this menace in the region? So for how long do you think there will be, and bear in mind, this is not exactly a region that all the actors behave in the same coherent manner at all in terms of foreign policy, but for how long do you think there will be patience, and like, do you think there will be fractures along that path? Like, where will this go?
It's not a matter of patience, it's a matter of strategy. So you want this to I think it is in the interest of all sides, Israel included, is to de-escalate the situation. Yes. Right now, and deal with the very severe humanitarian crisis. It's a disaster in Gaza. We're talking about over 85% of the buildings, of the infrastructure, is destroyed. So it's a major. I mean, Jared Kushner, who you can say is very sympathetic, mentioned that it looked like it was a hit by a nuclear weapon. okay, or an atomic bomb that was dropped in. So this is the level of destruction. So I think it's in everybody's interest is to de-escalate and start showing some hope and positiveness for the people of Gaza first and for the national security or regional security of this region. The main problem is so far is that we have a government that is first has a very effective military, but also its objectives is extreme. Its objective is maximalist, and actually some of these objectives are very unclear.
Okay.
Very unclear. And until a compromise is reached, I don't know how, either if this government change or if they started changing their approach to a solution, then we might see another round of violence, or this violence can escalate. When you see a large population movement into Sinai, I mean, Egypt may have a problem, big problem with that. When the Syrians are getting hit on a weekly basis, they may also have a problem with that. And state can maneuver, non-state can maneuver, as we saw in the case of Gaza, but also states can build capacities, can build fortifications, can be able to, if they want to fight, they will be able to fight. But it will it be in the interest of anyone in the region to escalate to that level and start another regional war? Or just got out of one, so it was ugly, and it was mainly non-state forces and Iran, which has no borders with Israel. Now Syria and Egypt have borders with Israel, so it's a big problem.
Okay. We've spoken about two big events in the region, Syria and Gaza. The other big event, obviously, is in Sudan, where again, the RSF have been accused by some people of political genocide. We don't have the time to go into depth of what's happening in Sudan, but a big stoker and a supporter of the RSF in Sudan has been the UAE. How do you think this impacts both, all three things, actually? What happened in Syria, the genocide in Gaza, and the UAE's sort of exposure in Sudan. How do you think it impacts the UAE?
So first, because we talked a bit about the developing capabilities when you don't have a choice, developing military capabilities to hit the other side because you don't have a choice. So here's the RSF, here's a force, militia, primarily a tribal militia within a regional civil war in Darfur that originated from there, that was patrolling and at some points even fighting on the horses of camels, on horses and camels. And now it can field long-range 1,200 kilometers strikes, precision strikes, that lands in Port Sudan from Darfur, from Niala, with to target command posts and weapon warehouses and so on, and can sustain that over a period, maneuvering the air defenses of the Sudanese armed forces and so on. So in terms of building capabilities and capacities, here you go, an example of a non-state force. Well, actually, it is a state force because Bashir made them a part of the Sudanese armed forces. In terms of their support, their support has helped a lot in building these type of capabilities. And the way the UAE was, the RSF is not the only non-state or hybrid force that they support. So you have the LNA in the case of Libya, you have you usually have the Southern Command Council or the Southern Council in Yemen and so on, multiple other, should we say, non-state forces. And the strategy that was employed is a very much a Sahwat strategy, if you think about it. It's the idea of employing a non-state force or managing a non-state force, local one, and make sure that it is loyal, and then supporting it either directly by, like the case of Yemen, special forces operations and close air support, but also by financing and training. And that will give you influence, political influence, and perhaps military and security reach in these areas. And that's happening and they're all critical areas, whether in Sudan, in Libya, in Yemen, in terms of geostrategic chokeholds, maritime routes, reach to the Mediterranean, very close to the Red Sea. In case of the RSF took the entire Sudan, it will be on the Red Sea. And also in Somalia, as you see, and as well in Yemen. So very critical geostrategic chokeholds. And you have a non-state force that is supported, trained, financed by you. So that's the strategy. The RSF is one part of that strategy, or one pillar, I would say. And actually, it's much more effective than some of the other pillars. The issue, major issue with it, is that it commits multiple crimes against humanity. We saw that in Fashir specifically. And that did not stop its external support, which is a big problem, big legal problem. It can be a big legal problem, but also it will be possibly a strategic problem in places like Sudan in case of these forces were defeated, whether in Sudan or in Yemen or in Libya. And that will have strategic problems for the patron.
Okay.
Decades.
We don't have enough time to talk about all of this. Thank you so much for your time. I'd love to have you on the show again at some point so we can really have a much more in-depth discussion on exactly how Sharaa became Sharaa. Because I think just given your knowledge and expertise and understanding, that whole discussion about how the militia started, what the impact of Iraq was, will be really interesting, and possibly Sudan as well. But just a final quick one before we leave, just do you trust Ahmad al-Sharaa?
No comment.
Okay.
How's it not comment? I've never met the person, so I wouldn't.
Okay, no worries.
Not comment, yeah.
Ahmad al-Sharaa, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Pierce. I really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not so unapologetic humans. Hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.